So, Peter, how did you get into the meat business?
Oh, God, Matthew. I remember vividly, my mother, God rest her, was a great entertainer, and she would have had people around for dinner and that sort of thing. And most of them all, she served a lot of lamb for some reason or another. I mean, we were farmers and we grew the lamb on our farm, so it was probably the most readily available and cheapest option. But everybody raved about the lamb that they ate when they came to our place. So guests or former guests, you say, where did the lamb come from? Oh, it came from our own farm in Muntingham. Oh, could we get some? Could we buy some from you in Muntingham? I remember one Sunday morning breakfast after they'd had a dinner party, and my mother touched my father and said, darling, the next time we're killing some lambs for the freezer, my sister Arlene would like a couple and my friend Hannah would like a couple. And he looked across the table at her and he says, sweetheart, I've enough to do without doing that. So anyhow, whenever he left to go down to the yard, she said to me, sweetheart, the next time we're doing lambs, just six for ourselves and six for somebody else. One thing in her. So anyhow, I got the 12 lambs and put them to where they were to go, and one thing in her. And my mother, when everybody got their lamb, she said, just keep doing that, sweetheart. So by the time I was 12, I was slaughtering about 20 lambs a week for people's freezers. And, you know, an average man's salary at that stage was probably £25 to £30. And I was knocking £100 a week after slaughtering these lambs. So I had a very, very clear vision early on as to what I wanted to do. And I couldn't wait to get out of school, you know, to get into the meat trade. And my father was quite sceptical about it. You know, he said, no, you need to go to university. You know, the Hannans veterinary would be for you and this, that and the other. But I remember clearly in 1978 when I finished my exams, I looked over my shoulder, I waved goodbye and I kept on walking. I started a week later working in a meat factory. And I spent a couple of years doing that, just kind of getting skilled up. And then I went out to America for a couple of years where, you know, out there people weren't, they didn't feel threatened by training you and teaching you and this, that, and you know, you were far enough away from home. And then I came back and I got an opportunity to run a meat factory that was in probably bother at the time. There was no risk because it was going down and we managed to save it. And all of a sudden, you get a reputation of somebody being able to do something good, and the opportunities come then. So yeah, I was in the meat trade from I was sort of 17. And then I spent sort of 12 years working with other people, Seamus Purcell and Peter Queeley, God rest them, and Munting are both very, very eminent people in the industry. And then in 1989, we decided to do it ourselves, and we've been doing it ever since. We know nothing else, so it's a good job we can do it.
I love how your mom accidentally kind of created the ultimate luxury product pipeline, where it's like throw a fancy party, get people to sample the goods, and then sell them on the back end.
It was so easy because I conducted it the whole way through boarding school. I mean, you know, things were very different back then, but I never attended school on a Monday. I bought lambs and then they went to the abattoir, and my mother would have rang the college on a Sunday evening and told me how many, you know, she had taken orders for during the week. And my father never knew until I think it came out one Sunday over lunch when I was in my sort of early mid-20s, and he let on that he knew, but he hadn't a clue.
That's hilarious.
My mother had nurtured it the whole way along. And you know, you get into things sometimes by accident. But, you know, my father was a very good farmer. We produced very good livestock, and I got a loving and a liking for it from a very early age. So it was always going to be something connected with agriculture. I didn't really want to farm. We had quite a substantial farming enterprise, which my father anticipated I would take over. But when we had the conversation, I said, boss, it's not what I want to do with my life. I just want to do something different, put my own thumbprints on something and try and do something better. And it ended up the meat trade. It could have been probably a number of other things, but that's where it was, and that's what we've done, and it's been very good to us. So we're eternally grateful.
Sure. Well, you do what you know. That's how you always start. And as you say, one thing leads to the other. You get the opportunities, and you kind of buckle up the seatbelt, yeah, go with the ride.
You do. Yeah, yeah. It's you know, quite often it's not planned. It evolves, and you know, my life has been very much evolution. You know, we don't plan things that terrible far ahead. You know, we just try and do the right thing and see what pops up, and then, you know, just continue to row the boat. That's kind of...
What part of America did you go to?
Primarily Illinois, Chicago.
All right.
That sort of thing. That was, I mean, the meatpacking houses of Chicago were sort of where the nucleus of...
And what was that like to go from over here to there? Like,
I'll never forget. It was the 6th of January, 1979. And I was 19 years of age, and I was landing into Chicago, and we were down very low because we were underneath a sort of a snowstorm. You know, when you're that far away from home and you're that young, I mean, I had been to boarding school, so I mean, I was quite independent and one thing, but you could see down, and it felt like we were flying over the city or Illinois for like half an hour, which is a long time in an airplane. And I remember vividly thinking, there's 5 million people down there and I don't know one of them. And, you know, look, people treat you the way you treat them. I mean, I suppose I arrived with two things, manners and respect. And, you know, it was, you know, the deal I had done was, you know, if you let me train, I'll start with the first man in the morning, finish with the last man in the evening. All I wanted to do was get the experience and went here. But, you know, the company that I went to work for, I mean, they were very, very good and kind to me. And I got great opportunities. And at that stage, America was probably 10 years in front of Europe. I wouldn't say that's the case today. But, you know, I returned having seen things and done things that hadn't been done here before. And it was a great advantage because you were able to introduce things that were probably going to come pretty soon anyhow, but you were sort of a little bit ahead of the pack. And, you know, that maybe gave me a head start.
Right.
You know, so.
So you came home with profit.
I came home with profit. I brought what was to, you know, keep me in sustenance for the time that I was there. But, you know, I didn't anticipate being paid. And then they paid me pro rata to what I was doing. And they gave me opportunity and they paid me very well and that sort of thing. I enjoyed it. They wanted me to stay there. But it was always the plan to come home. Mm. You know, I mean, I went to America and had a couple of wonderful years in it, but you know, it was always the plan to come home. Right. I never wanted to you know, stay over there. So
and you said one of the main motivators for leaving was because home was quite territorial in the industry, and maybe there was a bit of fear. I don't want to train this young guy up because maybe he's going to do X, Y, and Z.
Well, you know, there's that always exists. Sometimes we don't recognize it, but you know, there's always that sort of thing lurking there where, you know, am I going to train somebody up to be better than me in one thing? Or, you know, when you go far enough away from home, you remove that.
Right.
It's just not there. And, you know, the reason I went there is they were probably world leaders at the time. Either North America or South America would have been ahead of where Europe was. And, you know, I got an opportunity there. My uncle was the Consulate General from Ireland to America at the time. So getting a visa wasn't a difficulty. And, yeah, I got a 2-year visa and I went and made the most of the opportunity, which I was very grateful to get. And, yeah, that was the foundation and one thing. And I've loved every day of it. You know, the meat trade is a very, very difficult, tough business to be in. You're dealing with a product that you don't know what it's going to cost. You don't know what you're going to sell it for. It's a perishable product. And it has been a rough and tumble trade by reputation, you know, from Noah came down the car. And, you know, you could choose an easier occupation, but it's hugely rewarding and one thing or another. And I've enjoyed every minute. I don't feel like I've ever done a day's work in my life because I get out of bed in the morning to do what I love doing. And, you know, it has afforded me so many things, you know, worldwide travel, meeting wonderful people and things like that. And, you know, when you look back and say, what would you change? Yeah, it doesn't matter what you're doing, you're going to get tough days and tough weeks or tough times. But I wouldn't change a day of it. You know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
Right.
And, you know, we've been through BSE, foot and mouth, horse gate, all those things. And, you know, when you survive those, you come out of it better than you went into it. You know, even though it's a bit bruising. And, you know, you'll get moments. I mean, that Wednesday that BSE struck, I'll never forget it. you know, I taught her. Better ring my bank manager before he rang me.
So get out ahead of it. Invite him for lunch. Yeah,
that call was going to come, so you're better off being in front of it. And I remember ringing him and I said, how are you? I said, are you okay? He says, I'm great, Pete. He says, how are you? I said, we're first class. One thing, and you know, at that stage, every pound we had was buried in stock, and we were borrowed fairly heavily. It was the time of year where you carry a lot of stock, and we had a facility and we were right to the neck of that there. And, you know, when I told him we were okay and everything was flying, you know, I'd never told a lie. And that was probably a slight mistruth. I mean, I didn't know what we were facing into the following morning. But, you know, it all worked out okay. You manage those situations and you react.
Staring into the eye of the storm and being like, yeah, we can make it.
Well, you know, you've got to, because the one thing you can't do is you can't quit. I mean, you know, you're in there. That's your position, one thing. And you've got to make the best of whatever it is you have to play with. You get, that's the hand of cards. And that's the hand of cards you've got to play with, one thing. And, you know, down along the line, you get to throw away a few and get new cards, and you will get due. But, you know, the hand you have is the hand you're playing, and one thing, and if you have to bluff your way through to get there, that's what you've to do. I mean, that's poker, isn't it?
100%.
Something you also said earlier on about training as well. So training up different people. So how would that kind of like go? Like with the first person you trained up to be a meat merchant like yourself, how would you say that kind of went?
Yeah, when the rules reversed.
Yeah, look, you know, I've always said if you surround yourself with good people, they make you look great. And, you know, spreading the goodness is something I always think that any help you can give somebody without hurting yourself too much, you should always do. And, you know, we try in our own way to spread some of the goodness. You know, we're very, very fortunate to be in the position that we are in Muntingen. And if you can spread that out and you know, bring people along with you, and, you know, you'll come across situations where you'll see somebody and all they need is a little bit of a boost. Mm. And if we can, we do. We don't make too much about it, but as I say, we try and pull people along. And, you know, paying forward is a good way to work in life. You know, if you bring somebody along and one thing or and you need a turn or you need them to help somebody, you know, that's kind of a given. And, you know, look, we always try and work like that. You know, life is all about people. You know, everything else is really secondary. It's all about people. And if you have good young people around you that you can bring along with you, I mean, they're fastening the future, you know, and anything that you can do to sort of help people, you should always do it. And we're kind of that mindset.
Yeah.
You know, it's not about us. We've plenty, you know, but if you can change somebody's life just because of something you have that you can do it, well, you know, there's a kind of a responsibility or an obligation on you to do that, in my opinion, you know. So that's our kind of ethos or attitude and one thing or another. And I think, it's sort of quietly rewarding. You know, we take, you know, private pride in sort of being able to do things like that.
Of course. So you go out on your own. What was that like? And, you know, what were kind of the early years of setting all that up?
Yeah.
Because it's different whenever you go out under the covering and all of a sudden it's just you standing out there in the cold.
Well, you know, when you have the security of maybe been with a major corporation and in my case been a very senior position inside and that, you know, there's a security that goes with that. But, you know, is that what you want to do all your life? You know, in my case, it wasn't. I wanted to.
Because you were very well paid.
Yeah, I was, I think, the highest paid executive in Ireland when I was 22 years of age. So it was never about, it was never about the money.
So not just in your industry, In every industry?
I was
holy smokes.
I remember Aspect magazine put me on the cover, unbeknown, as I say, as the highest paid executive in Ireland in 1982. It was never about the money. We were working away and very, very successfully. So, you know, it kind of came with the territory. But, you know, it's 40 years of your life, you have to kind of look forward and say, is this what I want to do for the next 40 years? And in my case, it wasn't. I wanted out of the fast lane. I had kind of done that. It was fine, but I...
enough of the private jets.
I had done it in one thing, and I just wanted to try and make a difference and put our own thumbprints on something and do something a little bit better. You know, our industry was kind of like peeling bananas, numbers, volume, and that sort of thing. And that did nothing for me. You know, it was about how can we improve the eating quality? How can we, you know, make things more sustainable? There was a lot more things at play rather than just, running a machine. And, in 1989, I jumped ship and just said, here, we'll go on and do something ourselves. And we started a little trading company above a fish and chip shop in Moira. And that did us for a year or two. And then we built a small factory and we just started to spread out. We never intended to get into food service. It was never really our thing. But we evolved into that there and we really enjoyed it. We liked the sort of the cut and thrust of chefs and, you know, dealing with different people and people bringing you challenges and that sort of thing. And that kind of ticked our box. I know some people would regard it as aggravation. It to us, it never was. It was, you know, when you're in the service industry, you're providing a service. And, you know, that was the service we were to provide, was to satisfy the requirements of, I think we do somewhere over, throughout Ireland, the UK and Europe, we do somewhere over 400 restaurants. So we're dealing with 400 different chefs. And there's no two exactly the same. And, you know, we love the personalised individuality and one thing. And, you know, we're very fortunate. We deal with some very eminent, highly talented people. And, you know, they're what make you good.
Right.
They're the ones who say, Pete, you know, we're thinking of something like this and one thing. And, you know, they rely on you to solve their problems for them. So, you know, you're constantly challenged and that sort of thing. But, you know, without being challenged, you don't move forward. And, you know, we've been fortunate enough that we've been able to take things forward and one thing another. And, you know, the whole bar has raised substantially over the last 20, 25 years compared to what it was then. And, you know, we've been some part of that there. And, you know, it's... Yeah, as I say, some people find it challenging. We actually embrace that. We love it. Working with very, very good people is very rewarding. And as I say, we're very honoured and privileged to have that opportunity every morning we get up. So, that's what we do for a living.
So that drive for quality, you know, like you move from kind of quantity to quality there.
Yeah, well,
like what's that all about?
That was where our ambition lay. We wanted to move out of the quantity thing. We wanted to move out of the commerciality. We wanted to move into something more bespoke and something more individual and one thing and something far more personal. And you know, there's no such thing as food that's too good. You know, there's not. And you know what? What we can do today as opposed to what we could do 25 or 30 years ago is radically different. But, you know, you've got to keep on laying those blocks and building those foundations so as you continue to build on it. And, that's the challenge to anybody. You know, the difference, I don't care what walk of life you're in, it certainly applies to us, and this is one... We actually have it on a poster or a sign inside in our factory. The difference between good and great in every walk of life is exactly the same thing. It's attention to detail. You know, the little thing that somebody thinks doesn't matter is quite possibly the one thing that makes a huge difference. And we have analysed always the little things. The big teams tend to take care of themselves. And, you know, you'll notice those. But if you want to take something good and make it great, you've got to go after the little things. And, you know, the attention to detail is the one thing that makes all the difference. And, you know, people say to me, what advice would you give a young person or blah, 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 whatever. And it always comes back to that, you know, attention to detail. You know, analyze in detail all of the small things. Because when you bolt five little small things together in your process, whatever it is that you're doing, don't think for 1 minute that they don't make a big difference. Each individual one is like one link. But when you put five of those together, now you've got a chain. And that chain, your chain, is the one that makes a difference.
Hmm. There's a short for you right there, Oscar.
I've already noted it down. Now, something you did say earlier about meeting a bunch of different chefs and all that across the world. Is there any chefs that really stood out to you in a way that, you know?
Oh, God, look. You know, people
who's your favorite
say,
child?
Look, I mean, you know, one in particular, you know, shines. God, we deal with so many wonderful, unique and highly talented people. And I don't want to drop names because if I do, you know, there will ones that I want to say and I won't have. But one that I'm very, very happy to say was, it's back about 15 years ago, and a great friend, long-time client and tremendously talented individual. Most people will know him as a household name, Mark Hicks. And Mark had been running a huge empire for somebody else in London and had gone out on his own and opened this restaurant in London, down beside Smithfield Market. And we had a business above in Newcastle upon Tyne, and the guys wanted to go to London to Mark Hicks's restaurant for the Christmas do and munting. And I said, December the 12th, boss, we're going to do it. Will you come over? And so needless to say, I was there. And we'd had dinner, and I was the only smoker in company. And I went out to take the air, so to speak. And who walked out while I was having a cigarette? Only Mark. And, you know, his restaurant was only open maybe 2 or 3 months. And I'll never forget, because it was a kind of a day that changed our, you know, our whole future. And he said, good evening. He says, you've been in the restaurant for dinner? I said, I have. And he says, everything all right? And I said, And, you know, you get to a junction and you kind of, it's a crossroads, and you kind of think, yeah, the easy thing is just to go straight on and right. Say, yes, everything was lovely, thank you. He had no idea who I was, obviously. I mean, I knew very well who he was. And I just thought, oh, God, I can't be arsed telling him, you know, just waffle. I said, you know, you have a very, very nice restaurant, but I said, your meat could be better. And I thought, oh, God, I've insulted the man. And he looked over and he looked at Smithfield Market and he said, do you see over there? That's the biggest meat market in Britain. And he says, I'm within 100 yards of it. And he says, I can't get the meat that I want.
Wow.
And I put my cigarette out and I was walking past him back into the restaurant. And I said, you know, if you've a day in the new year to rip up, I said, why don't you come to Northern Ireland? And I said, I'll show you something you've never seen before. And he whipped a card out of his pocket like a shot. And he didn't even know my name at this stage. He certainly didn't know that I was in the meat trade or one thing, although that was starting to become apparent. And he said, you will call me, won't you? And I said, no. I said, I've told you I'll call you. So I said, that will happen. I said, whether you decide to come or not, I said, that's entirely up to you. So in the middle of February, one Saturday evening, I just dropped an email and just said, you maybe don't remember me. I'm the guy who told you your meat wasn't wonderful outside your restaurant in December. But if you're still up for coming to Ireland, give me a few dates that work and come on over. So within 10 minutes, I had a response and he said, can I come for 2 days? And I said, you can come for as long as you like. And one thing. So The following day, his PA rang me and we lined it up and he came over and we showed him what we were doing and this, that and the other. And he said, I'm leaving him off at the airport. And he got out of the car and he said, I've had a wonderful time, he said, and I've good news and bad news for you. And I said, oh, okay. I said, well, you don't know me well enough, but I said, I'm bomb-proof. So I said, you're going to hit me either way, whatever way you like. And he said, last night I ate the best steak I've ever eaten. I said, I'm hoping that's the good news. But I said, how do you follow that with bad news? And he said, the bad news, he says, is you're my new meat supplier. And I said, Mark, I said, look, I didn't bring you here to sell you anything. I said, I can't give you the service that I would want to give you just right now because I said, the logistics chain isn't in place. But look, I said, maybe sometime in the future. But I said, look, I can help you. I said, I know people who would be able to supply in the UK, blah, 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 and one day. So anyhow, we became very good friends. We went fishing together and things like that there. And he introduced us to an enormous amount of wonderful people. And, you know, our business started to thrive in one thing. And about 2 years later, things changed and he rang one evening looking for something. And I said, I can send you that. And he said, oh, he says, well, then you can send me the beef as well, can't you? And like, we opened 8 restaurants together in London. And, you know, it was just one of those, you know, if you mark down a time in your life that, you know, one small thing changed a lot of things. That would be one of the things that would be, you know, a marker in our time. And as I say, subsequently, you know, when you were good enough to supply Mark Hicks, who was regarded as one of the, you know, the most fastidious, precise, detailed people about sourcing and this, that, and you know, when you were good enough to supply Mark Hicks, you were good enough to supply a lot of people. And, right. You know, so many things came down our pipe as opportunities because of that, for which we were hugely grateful. But, you know, we can trace a lot of them back to, you know, people. And it is a network, you know, within our industry. You know, it's kind of stays in the industry, but everybody knows everybody and you get invited to something and you meet somebody and then they come over and this, that, and the other. So, yeah, we're very privileged. We deal with a lot of wonderful people on a day-to-day basis, a lot of them household names, and we've had a lot of people visit us in Northern Ireland and one thing and another. And Northern Ireland has made huge, huge ground over the last 15 years. I mean, some of the things that were going on here that weren't recognised, you know, the closet doors were open and all the things came out of the closet. I mean, you've wonderful artists and produce, you've wonderful, you know, the raw materials that we have here. And, you know, they have made huge inroads in the last 10 or 15 years. And, you know, they're getting a worldwide reputation, which, you know, is just fabulous for everybody. And, you know, the same as it is within that network, I say, there's a network here that works. And, you know, we all try and help each other and introduce, you know, cross-pollinate and introduce to others and one thing. And, you know, the future success of business is not in individual things. It's about collaboration. You know, I can only do so much. And then when I pass it on to somebody else, they have to do their bit in one thing. So, you know, it's all about collaboration. And, you know, this thing of, you know, shrouding what you're doing in one thing and another, as I say, it's probably not the right way to do it. You're better off, as I say, surround yourself with good people, associate with good people and collaborate with good people. You'll get an awful lot more traction that way than you will out of trying to do it all yourself, because you cannot do it all yourself, you know. So, you know, working with good people is a very, very privileged thing and, you know, should be embraced. And, you know, when that opportunity presents itself, you know, straight up and do it.
That attention to detail. So one of our first interviews was about 6 years ago, 6-7 years ago with Michael Dean. And at that time, we were wetting ourselves to have the chance to sit down with Michael because we had, you know, nothing. We hadn't talked to anybody. And he took us in the restaurant and we brought the cameras. We're like, make sure the cameras are working. And we were all nervous. And he was, you know, wearing his whites and everything. And I remember then, so your episode will be maybe like 360 or something like that. And I remember him telling me a story about you.
Oh, God.
And it always stuck in my head. So I'm glad I have the chance to kind of verify it. He says, you know, you got to speak to this guy. You got to speak to this guy. His attention to detail is crazy. And he told a story, and I only remember it in parts.
He would know because Michael is
about Himalayan
salt,
salt or stones or building something or like. So what's tell us that?
Yeah, it's look, Michael, very very kind. Michael would know about attention to detail because nobody practices that more than he does. You know, Michael's. Nobody needs me to say. He's a tremendous individual and, you know, has put Northern Ireland culinary on the map over. I think we started in business at the same year, you know, and, you know, I'm huge, huge fan of what Michael does. Yeah, the salt age and, God, yeah, funny. it was a little bit after that time with Mark Hicks. You know, he was opening this restaurant in London, a huge 300-seater restaurant called the Tramshed. And he rang me one Monday morning and he said, I need to see you. And I said, well, what do you want to do? He says, I'll come over on Wednesday. And I didn't know what he was coming over for. I knew he wasn't going bust or anything. But he came over and he said, I'm going to tell you something. And he says, you're going to think I've been drinking. And I said, well, and he says, we're opening another restaurant. I said, well, that doesn't shock me. He says, no, but he says, Pete, this is a big, big restaurant. And he says, we're only going to serve two things, chicken and steak. He says, what do you think of that? And I said, well, so long as it's very good chicken and very good steak, I said, I think that's nailed on. I said, I think that's great. And he says, we'll have the chicken sorted out and the beef is your problem. So I started to tell him about stuff that we had been working on for probably 7 or 8 years was a dry aging process involving the use of Himalayan salt. And, you know, people say, what is it? It's a process that provides the perfect environment in which to age beef. And basically, the salt is purifying your environment and things like that there and bringing a lot of properties to it that aren't normally there. But I was telling him about this and same thing. We got to the airport and he said, look, what about this salt beef? I said, Mark, it's not salt beef. In Ireland, salt beef is corned beef. It's salt aged beef. Yeah. But he says, can we have that for the restaurant open? I said, how soon is it open? He says, oh, I think this was maybe May and he was opening it in November or something like that, in time for Christmas anyhow. And I said, look, I said, okay, I said, I'll get to work on it. And I said, I'll stay in touch with you in one thing. And so he was walking away and he turned around and he says, I'll come and lay the last brick in it for you. And I said, why don't you get on that bloody plane? I said, and get off this island. But anyhow, we set about trying to find somebody who could provide us with a quantity. We needed about 5 ton of salt bricks to build this first chamber. And we came across this little man who had a food-grade salt mine in Pakistan. Now, this sounds like something out of a fairy tale, but this is how it worked. So we got in contact with him, and he didn't want to entertain us because we needed the salt. He wanted to give it to us in big lumps. And we said, no, it has to be cut. It has to be in bricks. And one thing, no, I can't do that. And it'd be too expensive. And one thing, and we said, well, look, you know, it's not about the expense. Can you do it? And one thing. So he came back a few days later and said, okay, I can cut the bricks. And one thing. But he says, I need your money up forward. Okay. So we were sending this money out to Pakistan. Like with on a wing and a prayer, hoping that someday we'd get salt bricks. But he told us it would take 5 months and we said, no, we can't wait.
5 months?
Yeah, 5 months to cut this stuff. So anyhow, about 6 weeks later, he must have got excited. He sends this message. One morning we get in and this message Skyped and one thing and I said, Mr. Peter, he says, great news. He says, your salt is ready and it's leaving the mine tomorrow. So needless to say, we were ecstatic. One thing, come in the following morning, Mr. Peter, we have a problem. We've had 4 foot of snow overnight and we can't get out of the mine for the next 3 weeks. And one thing, I thought, oh, Jesus, what's this about?
Oh, boy.
So anyhow, eventually we got the salt out of the mine and they got it down to the port. And what did they do? Only put it on the wrong boat and it ended up in Dubai.
Oh, no.
So we finally track down where the salt has gone in Muntingener, and we managed to get it put on another ship from Dubai into Felixstowe. But when it gets into Felixstowe, customs and excise see this 5 ton of product from Pakistan. And needless to say, it was going to get investigated, but they impounded it and they said they'd need it for 2 weeks. And they eventually released it, having confirmed it wasn't drugs. And the stevedores wouldn't move it because the pallets were too heavy and their insurance wouldn't cover it. And they wanted £500 a day demurrage to store it. And no haulier wanted to pick it up and bring it over to Northern Ireland, one thing, so we were in a jam. So one of our own lads took one of our vehicles over on a Sunday, went into the port in Felixstowe, pretty well stole our own salt, got it loaded on the lorry and came back. And I rang our bricklayer, Murphy, and said, "Murph, I said, I need you urgently. We've a wall to build." And he comes round on one thing and he's expecting to see concrete blocks and he sees these blocks of salt and he says, "Sweet Jesus." He says, "What are you doing now?" And I said, "Well, I said, we're going to build a wall." And actually, I got a plaque, a silver plaque, and it's still on the wall 13 or 14 years later. And the plaque says, "Made by God, built by Murphy." So he was chuffed. He was chuffed. But we got this thing finished in about a week. And it was a Saturday lunchtime we finished. And I went up to the office and I remembered the words that Hixie had said, "I'll come and lay the last brick for you." So I just thought, here, I have my moment. So I rang the phone and I got this international dial tone. I was just about to hang up whenever I heard, "Pete, what is it? Everything all right?" And one day I said, "Oh yeah." I said, "Yeah, great. I said, just to let you know, I said, we finished the salt chamber." And I said, "I need you to come and lay the last brick." So he says, I'm in Dubai on my way back from Eat Australia. But he said, I'll see you soon. And the phone went dead. So anyhow, I hadn't time to tell him. I was winding him up on one thing. And I'm waiting to try and contact him when the flight landed into Heathrow. But I couldn't get through. And the next thing he rings and he says, "I'm on an Aer Lingus flight here." He says, "I'll see you in about an hour and a half." So this is Saturday. This is Saturday night. I pick him up at the airport and we dined well, and I brought him in on the Sunday and showed him the salt chamber, and he was blown away. And he said, "How much can you hold in here?" And I said, "Oh, lots." I said, 600 loins and ribs and one thing. He says, "We'll take everything."
Wow.
And I said, no, I said, "I can't give you everything. I said, I need some for us." He says, "No," he says, "Pete, we'll need it all because we're going to be busy." And, you know, 6 weeks after we started, he cleaned us out and we had to build another one. So we've since built 4 of them. And the next one we built was 5 times bigger than the first one.
Oh my
and
word.
I was just about able to keep up with them. And then, you know, obviously other things came along and one thing or another. But yeah, it produces a really lovely, consistent product. And, you know, we start with the single most inconsistent raw material in the world, because you'll never eat the same steak twice. Every animal is different and one thing or another. So, you know, bringing a level of consistency through the process is as good as we can do. And to some extent, we've managed to do that, where, you know, the worst you should ever get is very good.
Mm.
But, you know, we strive for something better than that. You know, if you get a really good steak, it's a really lovely thing. And nobody wants to get one that isn't. So, yeah, you know, we're constantly tweaking and working away. And as I say, it's that attention to detail again. And if you can make, you know, if you're looking for 2 or 3% and it's in it, you should be trying to squeeze that 2 or 3% out of it, you know, to try and, you know, all we can claim is we make it as good as it can be.
Mm.
And then it's back to your raw material and that sort of thing. But look, it works well. And yeah, just... that's why we get up in the morning today.
Sure. So switching gears slightly then for the business owner listening, because you, as well as your success in the meat industry, you know, you've bought or invested or helped out dozens and dozens of businesses yourself. I was thinking on the way in, I was like, you know, lots of people work in meat, but very few people are able to to bring it to that level of excellence. And I think that that's the same for a lot of businesses. You know, a lot of people are in podcasting, or a lot of people are in software development, or a lot of people are in, you know, construction. How do you take it to that higher level?
Well, you know, I'm coming back to it again, attention to detail. I mean, you know, I think no matter what you're doing, you know, if you try and do it better, I always say if you're only cutting turf in the bog and you do it better than anybody else, you'll succeed. Mm. You know, people look on a lot of individuals who maybe have a business. One thing, you know, running a business is, it's not an easy thing. It's not an easy thing. But, you know, when you get your feet under the table in whatever it is you're doing, you should always try to do it better. You know, I always say if you're swimming up in the clean water, you know, it's a really nice place to be as opposed to the muddy puddles halfway down. You know, so doing something really, really well will nearly always succeed. And if you're in business, you know, never take anything for granted. And it always comes down to people. You know, it always comes down to people. Surround yourself with good people in whatever facet of your business you're doing. You know, have good people around you, whether that's directly or indirectly. You know, always have good people because they'll make you look great. You know, it's them who'll make you look great. You can only do so much on your own. And, you know, it's always about a team effort. It's always about, you know, what, you know, to give things to individuals. I've been fortunate, I've been the recipient of many, many different accolades and one thing. Yeah, it's not about an individual, it's about a team. You know, teamwork is, if you can bring people along with you and imbue them and reward them accordingly in one thing and others, as I say, that's where business will thrive. You know, if you get a lot of people pushing in the same direction, you can create some traction and do some damage. You know, so I think a lot of those things apply across, you know, a multitude of businesses. Ours is quite specific and you know, it's a tough business in one thing or so. We probably learn the lessons harder or whatever. But, you know, all businesses like that, you know, do it as best you can. Pay attention to the small things and surround yourself with good people. I'd say those are probably the criteria that we would concentrate on most, man.
Yeah. What's been the most challenging moment so far? Like the sweat and blood through your forehead, that sort of moment?
You know, I suppose back in the early days when you're starting off and, you know, you don't have a lot of wriggle room and you're not in a position to make too many mistakes. You know, we all make mistakes all the time. Like, I mean, you know, you can cover them up if you like, but, you know, expose them, learn from them and move on is the way we handle it. You know, BSE was definitely, I mean, that looked like a wipeout that day. You know, if somebody said one moment in 40 years, that was probably it. Because, I mean, you know, it was, it just looked like a total wipeout that day. We suspected that it would recover and recover fairly quickly, and it did. But, you know, you didn't know that. I suppose we're quite fortunate in that, you know, we don't do a lot of blood and sweat and one thing, or, you know, whatever hand of cards you have, play that there and one thing, or you'll change them later on and move on and one thing, or keep building and one thing, or and consolidate. You know, take a couple of steps and stop and consolidate and one thing, or and then, you know, you'll see where you are and you can move forward from that there. You know, you don't want to scatter too much. So, I suppose, you know, blood pressure is under control, so we're fine.
That's good. Glad to hear that. Two more questions. This is kind of how we always end, but if you could take anyone from Northern Ireland, dead or alive, out for a pint, who would you take? Where would you take them and why?
Oh, God, now there's probably a few contenders for that, but one springs to mind. If it was somebody alive, it would be It would be James Nesbitt, probably, but I have been on that trip with James and one thing and another, and it was hugely enjoyable and memorable. But John Hume, God rest him, was a man that, you know, I've been in Northern Ireland since 1982, and things have changed, progressed, etc. in many ways, all for the better. But he left a mark on me, you know, because he was a man of such integrity. You know, he was hugely influential in changing Northern Ireland from what it was to what it is. And, you know, I'm not a great one for formality. You know, the formal bullshit does nothing for me. I've seen and had plenty of it in Muntinger. But, you know, I'd take him to a pub and have a pint, probably a couple of pints with him. And then I'd go to the somewhere off round the coast and have fish and chips, and we'd probably be dressed in shorts and just T-shirts and just shoot the breeze. You know, I never met the man, but, you know, I always admired his style, his frankness, his integrity. Probably a lot of things that I can relate to in my own life, I would have admired them in abundance in him. And, yeah, if he was still alive, I'd wheel him up and fish and chips, here we come.
Unbelievable. Daniel, land the plane, let's go.
All right. So you said earlier about giving advice to other people. So my question for you is, if you could go in a time machine back to a 17-year-old version of yourself, what would you say?
Oh, God. What would I say? Look, you know, probably, you know, we were fortunate that we were reared to have honesty and integrity. And I'd say in modern day business, they are two of the things, you know, transparency, integrity, and honesty. You know, modern day business works with those qualities. And, you know, you go back 40 years, there was a lot of fly-by-night stuff. I'm not saying it's as straight as an arrow today in the world. It's not. But, you know, those are qualities that you have got to adhere to in your business. You know, those things are paramount. Those are foundation stones. You know, because if you don't have those, you know, your foundations aren't solid. But if you have those in, if you have those as pillars in each corner, you've something proper to build on. Mm. And you know, it's almost a requirement of business today is, you know, how you run it, how you look after people, how you, you know, conduct yourself. And, you know, when I was 17, those things weren't necessarily the same pillars, but they would be what I would say to myself, that if you're going to go forward in business today, and I was 17, I would have one of those in each corner and I would build off those foundations, because without them, you know, you're not rock solid. But if you have those things in there, you know, and it might mean sometimes that the road is a little bit longer, you know, but you'll be better off for having travelled that road than any of the B roads. You know, you're kind of on the motorway if you have those there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I would say those are absolute, absolute essentials.
Brilliant. Peter, thank you for your time. Loved it.
It's been lovely to be here, Matt, and thank you very much. As I say, I hope you hadn't much trouble enduring it.